A new report on the solvency of Social Security and Medicare is sparking renewed debate about the future of these crucial programs. While both programs are overwhelmingly popular, Wall Street never stops dreaming up ways to turn them into sources of profit or eliminate them altogether.
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
Very excited to have Professor Richard Wolff join us for a regular weekly segment where we discuss the biggest stories relating to the economy, the state of the working class, and the crimes of big business. I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker. The Socialist Program brings you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show. Richard Wolff is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work and the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Check out all of his work at rdwolff.com. Well, Professor Wolff, these reports on the solvency of Social Security and Medicare come out periodically. They typically spark some debate, discussing scheming among politicians and Wall Street bankers. The latest numbers are that under the current circumstances, Social Security has enough money to last until 2035, and Medicare has enough money to last until 2036 before they become, quote unquote, insolvent or unable to meet their full obligations as they stand today. Medicare and Medicaid, I mean, we can talk about how these programs themselves work, but I think it may actually make even more sense to start off talking about the programs, their role in U.S. society and the U.S. economy, because there's really no issue in Washington like Medicare and Social Security. Why do these programs have this special status? Why are they so popular? Why are they so important?
Well, let me respond by saying that history, as always, is a really good guide. The Social Security program was set up in the depths of the Depression of the 1930s. At a time when the government had no money, when tens of millions of people were out of work, when the conditions of the working class, in short, were horrible. But, and here's the crucial story, when that happened in this country, and it's so important to remember, the political complexion of the American working class moved sharply to the left. In other words, labor unions took off in a way that never happened before, and I was about to say has never happened since, but the last two or three years suggest we are in the process of seeing a rerun of the surge of labor unions. But what also happened in the 1930s, in the depths of the Depression, was the fantastic rise of two different socialist parties and a communist party here in the United States, who suddenly got masses of more members and became much more active and much more influential in American society. The pressure of the unions and of the socialist and communist parties was magnified because they worked together, they allied, and one of the things they pushed for was the Social Security system. That people who had given a lifetime of work in this country should not retire in poverty, in desperation, but should be able to retire with a decent, supportive pension that they had accumulated across their lives, and that the government could and should take the lead in establishing that, supporting that, handling, collecting the money, investing it in government securities so that it would not be subject to the ups and downs of stock markets, etc. And so that was done. And it has been popular ever since. And the reason is simple. it's absolutely crucial for tens of millions of American families that that money is there, even though it has been allowed to erode in its size. It isn't as big a support as it once was and that it could and should be, but it is significant enough that not only do elderly people, people 65 and older, who receive this money, depend on it in all kinds of ways, but it is important to remember that their children, people in their 30s and 40s and 50s and so on, are also beneficiaries because they are not left to take care of the needs of their elderly parents financially as much as they might be, because the government pension, Social Security, has stepped in and is helping those elderly. So everybody, the elderly and the not elderly, are enormously helped and would be in serious trouble, which would take them 2 seconds to figure out, if that money were in fact cut back or eliminated. The second part of it, Medicare, is basically the mealy-mouthed equivalent in the United States of the much more generous national health services that exist in most other advanced countries and in many countries that aren't very advanced or wealthy economically. Canada has its national health program, Mexico has its, and every country in Western Europe does. All of those are better and more comprehensive than the Medicare program in this country. The most obvious fact that shows that is that you don't get Medicare until you're 65 years of age. Whereas, of course, you have medical needs beforehand, illness, injury, and so on, and those are covered in the National Health Services in most other countries. So what you have is a late catch-up program in the United States, Medicare, coming many years after Social Security, and a kind of the half-baked, stingy nod of the United States to what other countries take for granted as a national health insurance for everybody. But like with Social Security, anybody who has ever gotten reimbursed or had the benefit of Medicare, myself included, will tell you in an instant, Medicare pays roughly 80% of most of the illnesses and injuries it covers, and that makes all the difference. You know, in this country, a famous fact, a huge percentage of people who are poor, whose income falls below the poverty line, when you investigate how come you are in this situation, a majority of them tell you it's because of an injury or an illness or both for which they had to pay as young people or middle-aged people because they didn't have Medicare yet. And so once you understand that, you realize that, yeah, they're popular because our people depend on them for major supports in the course of their lives.
Well, thank you for laying that out, Professor Wolf. Yeah, I mean, to the extent that a social safety net exists in the United States, you know, as minimal and inadequate as it is, these are certainly the two pillars of it. Now, this conversation about solvency comes up pretty frequently. On the one hand, a lot of the times this is fear-mongering, right? It's essentially an effort to portray the programs as poorly run or inefficient, otherwise in need of major changes. And those major changes, of course, would benefit Wall Street investors and pharmaceutical corporations and the like. But at the same time, there are ways in which the programs are set up that are actually pretty favorable to the wealthy. And fixing those things, to the extent that financial problems do actually exist, fixing those things would address this quote-unquote solvency issue. For instance, Social Security, once you make past a certain dollar amount, the money above that dollar amount is not taxed towards Social Security contributions. And so that's a common fix that people propose. Well, if we just tax the earnings of high-income individuals, that could solve it too. So, I mean, just talk a little bit about this pattern, if you will, you know, this effort to portray these programs as perpetually being in crisis.
Okay, and I'll try to be polite, but this is so outrageous what is going on that it is hard, but I will try. The attempt to accuse the funds of being insolvent is as old as Social Security. You were right. It's frequent, but it's more than frequent. It's literally the whole life. The business community and the rich fought against Social Security when it was proposed. We didn't get Social Security until many years into the Depression because of the opposition of corporations and the wealthy corporations, that is, and the individuals at the top of corporations whom we call the wealthy in our country, right? So it's a program that they don't want, never wanted, fought against, and have resented from day one. Now, why? Well, you know the reason why, because it's the ideology of capitalism that anything that the government does is somehow bad and evil, and it should be done by private people who can make a profit off of it. This is, of course, an ideology invented by and serving profiteers, people who are at the top of the corporate ladder, who live off of profits, want every opportunity to make more of them. They don't like it that the government is raising money through deductions on our salaries and then investing that money in government securities to make it grow and be available to pay out the costs of Medicare and the pensions, the Social Security benefits older people get. And so accusing it of being insolvent becomes a kind of ideological club. You can beat up the Social Security system, threaten, as is being done as I speak, threaten to the people who depend on it that they're in danger of having it stop in 2035 or whatever year they come up with. By the way, that varies from year to year. I can assure you as a professional economist that we have no idea what the world economy will look like in 2035. We can't even figure out what it'll look like in 2025, let alone 2035. Therefore, projections of these numbers onto that situation is an exercise in make-believe, and you shouldn't take it seriously for 1 minute. Everything that happens between now and 2035 will affect the conditions of the Social Security funds and the Medicare funds maintained by the government. Nobody knows the future, and therefore these statements about what will happen when are not to be taken seriously by any intelligent person. Now let's get to what the predictions are based on, because they reveal injustice built in to the Social Security system. First of all, the one you mentioned. I believe the number now is about $160,000 a year. So the way it works is Social Security takes out of your salary and an equal amount matched by the employer, an amount up to the first $160,000 a year you get, which means the overwhelming majority of Americans who earn way less than $160,000 a year. But if you are one of our millionaires, if you're one of the 1% at the top, for example, who earn well over $160,000 a year, guess what? Every dollar over $160,000 is not taxed for Social Security. The richest people among us don't pay Social Security taxes on much and often most of their income. Now, there is no justification for this at all other than pandering to the rich. That was a deal, a concession made by Franklin Roosevelt, the Democratic president of the United States, when Social Security was passed. This kind of an arrangement was a deal to the Republican Party and to the conservatives in his own party who didn't want Social Security. And when they finally allowed it to pass, they insisted and got an arrangement where the richest among them would be exempted from it. So one of the ways you can easily make the fund solvent is to say, wait a minute, everybody's income should be taxed the same rate, not just the first $160,000 currently paying, but everybody above that. That little minority, 1 or 2% of our people who earn more than $160,000 a year, have to do what everybody else is asked to do, and that is to fund a pension for elderly folk that is a sign that you are a decent society as opposed to what we have. Let me give you a second example. The Social Security deduction is only from your wage and salary income. There is no Social Security deduction if you get other kinds of income. What is that? If you have land that you rent out, the rent you get doesn't have to pay Social Security tax. If you have money that earns interest, you don't have a Social Security deduction on your interest income. And of course, here's the most important one. If you are earning dividends because you own shares of stock, or you're making capital gains by buying shares at one price and selling them at a higher price, all of that income, rent, interest, dividends, capital gains, is exempt from paying Social Security at all. Not on the first dollar, not on any other. And of course, who owns the bulk of the rent receiving land, the interest receiving money, the shares that yield dividends and capital gains? Here's the summary. The top 10% get 80% of all that income. So once again, built into the system are the enormous exemptions for the richest people. If you said that taking care of the elderly, as is done by the national insurance programs across the world, is part of what makes your society decent, you're not going to have a vast array of desperately poor elderly people. You're going to recognize a lifetime of work, whether it's raising a family or working in a factory or an office. Well, then you would say we all participate in funding the decency of our society. We don't exempt the richest ones amongst us, because that is frankly disgusting. I told you I'm trying to be polite. So you want to worry about the solvency of the Social Security system? All you got to do is correct the horrific pandering to the richest amongst us. That's the people who need it least, by giving them an exemption, which would matter least to them because they're rich, when we should be, if anything, taxing them more because they have a greater ability to pay. We reverse it and pay them less. Once you understand that, as a good American, you ought to be embarrassed that we behave as a society in such a primitive, unjust way. And with Medicare, it isn't all that different. We don't give a medical insurance to you unless you're 65. My heavens, we all need it. Young parents need it so they can raise their children. Children need it so they can get the proper care and grow into adulthood. We need medical care for everybody. That's why they do it in most other developed countries. That's why we are once again embarrassing ourselves around the world by the stinginess and the injustice. Rich people can afford medical care. Poor people can't. Middle-class people only with difficulty. The injustice built in, the favoritism to the rich, is a leftover of a time when corporations called the shots. Now, many of us fear that we're back in such a time, and there's plenty of evidence that it is. But at the very least, we ought to honestly talk about these systems rather than indulging in scare programs, talking about some abstract idea of not having enough money when we've always had enough money. It's only a political question whether we're going to make the people at the top pay their reasonable share, which they're not doing now, and instead trying to scuttle a program that the vast majority of Americans, in poll after poll, decade after decade, have said they support 100%.
Professor Wolf, what we're talking about, the negative scenario that we're talking about, if Social Security, if Medicare is privatized, that's not just a hypothetical possibility. I mean, the big banks, corporate interests have actually succeeded in some countries, not many, but in some countries, they have succeeded in privatizing the pension program. in privatizing the retirement system. So if Social Security were privatized, what would it mean for workers? What would it actually look like to have the financial sector run the pension system?
Well, the most widely spoken of alternative, and that explains why Wall Street is drooling over all of this, people should understand the way Social Security works. They take 6%+ out of your salary, and the employer has to pay the equivalent amount, and they take those two contributions, and then what the Social Security system does is lend that to the federal government, and it gets in return IOUs, or treasury bonds, because the United States government has to repay the money given to it, lent to it by Social Security. And the Social Security then uses the money that comes in each year from the deductions of people's wages and salaries, plus the interest they earn from the United States government, and that is paid out in Social Security checks, et cetera, et cetera. What the Wall Street wants is to privatize and to mean that private companies would take the money out of your wages and the matching sum from your employer, and they would invest it in the stock market. So people who work with stocks suddenly would see an avalanche of money coming into the stock market that doesn't come in now because it goes to the Social Security system, which in turn lends it to the government. So they see profit, 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 and that's all that's driving this nonsense about not having enough money and all the rest. They want to get their hands on it. But if that happened, then your pension would depend on how well they invested. Did they buy the right stocks that went up, or did they buy the stocks that went down? Your pension would also be damaged because they would take a healthy cut as a fee from managing your money, just the way they do now with money that they get their hands on. So you would be at the mercy of the stock market and at the mercy of these private companies handling the pensions, and that already exists with people who have 401k programs as we're speaking. And so that was always considered much too risky. You don't want to risk the pension that you're going to live on the last years of your life to the ups and downs of the stock market. If you happen to reach age 65 when you need the pension and the stock market is down that month, that week, that year, you could really be in trouble. And to avoid that, we created it with a Social Security system dealing only with the United States government, the most secure place to put your money. It was thought then, and by the way, it's thought that way now. So to go in that direction is to pander to private profiteers and to increase the risks that you take. And therefore, it has been rejected by people who know enough to see what's going on and to understand why it's important to ignore and stop it. And that applies to the noise now being made that they'll run out of money and all of that other crap. It really doesn't deserve the time we're giving to it, were it not for the fact that the people who corporations put into office, now that we have the best government money can buy, are using these arguments provided to them by the Wall Street profiteers because they see a lot of money in it, and that's all that this is about.
Okay, we have to leave it right there. We were joined by Professor Richard Wolf. He is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work, the author of many books. The latest is The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. You can check that out and all of his work at rdwolf.com. You've been listening to The Socialist Program. We bring you content several days a week thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to the show.
You've been listening to The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, where we bring you news and views about the world for those who want to change it. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and watch video episodes of our in-depth show, The Real Story, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube with our partner Breakthrough News. We can only continue our work bringing you high-quality news, analysis, and history with the support of our listeners. Connect with us and become a patron at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram and receive an invitation to participate in an exclusive monthly seminar with Brian Becker.